Thank you so much, Bill. There was a lot of music there I didn't know was even related to Cleveland after growing up in this neck of the
Bill,
woods.
Is that your jewel case?
Our next speaker is Deanna Adams. She's the author of Rock and Roll and the Cleveland Connection, which was named a 2003 finalist for an ARSC Award for Excellence in Research. She's also a finalist for an Ohiana Award, Book Award for Nonfiction. She's a freelance writer and a writing instructor. Her articles have been published, as I'm sure you all know, in magazines and journals, including Ohio Writer, Northern Ohio Live, The Cleveland Plain Dealer, Ohio Magazine, online City Music Magazine, and other publications. She's making some interesting noise back there right at the moment. The talk that she is going to present tonight is entitled Rock and Roll in Cleveland, Ohio. Please welcome Deanna Adams.
Thank you, Mary. Good evening, and welcome to this wonderful celebration of Cleveland music. For the next few minutes, I'd like to take you all back to where rock and roll first began. So sit back, close your eyes, and imagine. Opening scene, Mullen's Bar on Euclid Avenue, a popular downtown lunch and after-work hangout. The year, 1951. Characters, a record store owner named Leo Mintz and a former Akron disc jockey named Alan Freed, who hosts an afternoon movie show on Cleveland's WZEL-TV Channel 9, later to be WJW Channel 8. The two strike up a conversation and discover a mutual interest in music, as well as a strong desire to achieve career success. The stimulus. Freed wants back into radio after he left Akron station WAKR, but due to a contract clause, has been temporarily banned from resuming his radio career. Mintz, on the other hand, has been contemplating a way to get his best-selling R&B phonograph records, then called Race Music, played on the radio. Motivation, a steady round of beers. Outcome, better than expected, to put it mildly. Act one, the scenario takes place at the Record Rendezvous, Leo Mintz's downtown record shop, fast becoming the single largest record store in Northeast Ohio. Its success is largely due to the weekly, sometimes daily trips Mintz takes to a Columbus warehouse to retrieve personally selected records by artists his customers crave. In addition, he gives shoppers complete access to their favorites by openly displaying the records along the walls and in bins throughout his store. Prior to this, records were kept behind the counter, available upon request. He had begun this practice when he first opened in 1939, and the easy access has continually attracted customers from all over Ohio. Mintz is also one of the first to provide listening booths, a closed-in room with headphones, so prospective buyers can preview a record before making a purchase. Does that sound familiar? Anybody been to Borders lately? Although the store is located in the inner city, comprised of a fairly high number of blacks, the room is teeming with white teenagers who arrive from nearby suburbs. They come to sift through the boxes stuffed with R&B records. Mintz is baffled as he observes this interesting phenomenon that's becoming a daily occurrence. The adolescents choose to listen to records by black artists like Bessie Smith, Fats Domino, Ruth Brown, Amos Milburn, Charles Brown. They spend hours singing and dancing to the jazzy tunes, yet always leave empty-handed. And Mintz knows why. Race music is simply not accepted in the white community. Therefore, parents would have a cow if their children came home with such records. The businessman's mental wheels begin turning. If only he could put a different spin on how the music is perceived. Enter the ever-eager Alan Freed. The plot thickens. Mintz, who has some pull at WJW Radio as one of its sponsors, gets his new friend a job there, enabling Freed to resume his disc jockey career. But this charitable opportunity isn't given purely out of generosity on Mintz's part. He has an ulterior motive. After inviting Freed to his record shop to observe the interesting scene taking place there, the store owner convinces the disc jockey to play some of the records so popular with his customers during his nightly broadcast. Although hesitant at first, his program is basically a classical format. Freed knows not to bite the hand that feeds you. And after spinning the tunes of Della Reese, Big Al Sears, Red Prysack, Laverne Baker, Ivory Joe Hunter, and others, he is hooked. The music has exactly the kind of energy the young DJ himself emulates, and before long he is playing nothing but the sounds of these black artists. However, the music, attracting more of a white audience, and soon white recording artists like Pat Boone would be covering their songs, cries out for a new marketable title, The Conflict. The friendship between Mintz and Freed starts to deteriorate as the popular DJ begins taking full credit for the term rock and roll to identify the music that by the late 50s was fast becoming a million-dollar industry. Mintz has been using the phrase initially to describe his young customers' reactions to the music's beat, rock and roll, and thus feels slighted when Freed continually talks as if he alone invented the term. In truth, neither had. The phrase had been used as sexual innuendo since the 30s. In any case, it seems the term was apparently used by both men before either of them realized they'd found the marketing tool they'd been searching for. And while the whys and wherefores of the demise of this early friendship remain controversial, one thing is certain. These two insightful and determined men met and became drinking buddies at this Cleveland pub, and a faithful camaraderie formed out of a common bond of enterprising ambition. Dramatic irony. Mintz's initial plan to commercialize and bring a wider acceptance to the music indeed exceeded expectations, and both he and Freed benefited for a while. The two men went their separate ways when Freed, by then a national figure, took his creative showmanship to New York City in 1954, and ultimately became the man who brought the world rock and roll. He got all the glory, credit, and money, though he would end up unemployable and broke. Mintz, in turn, enjoyed his behind-the-scenes fortune throughout the 60s and 70s as his record rendezvous stores would grow in number and popularity, though his name would be forgotten by the general public within a decade of his death. But what won't be forgotten is the Cleveland Arena concert Mintz and Freed organized 52 years ago. The Moondog Coronation Ball, held on March 21, 1952, became the first rock and roll concert in music history. These two Cleveland men got the rock rolling, and soon there were others. Radio disc jockeys Bill Randall and Tommy Edwards were first to summon Elvis to perform north of the Mason-Dixon line in Cleveland, Ohio. An afternoon DJ, Pete Myers, transformed into Mad Daddy in the evenings on WJW AM and later WHK AM. He was the first to use a rapid rhyming delivery that became the gauge for the DJ style. Many tried to imitate him. Few succeeded, if any. Right, Bill?
You better believe it.
Here's a sample, and of course, you're going to hear a little bit. We should have collaborated before this, but here's a little of Mad Daddy at work.
Howdy doody, little stinkers, and welcome to my Thursday night, Land of the Winky Blinkers. My dream is pretty hot. Yeah, you can hear it flow. So welcome to another show.
I love that laugh. Love this. Listen.
Doing the alphabet, right?
From A to Z, all in one big breath. Indiating, bobbling, grabbing, dancing, elevating, fabricating, grouping, hoovering, idling, tickling, cooling, live operating, moping, noise making, who bottom debating, pooper quaking, breaking, shaking, taking, hoovering, ventilating, wiggling, x-raking, yo-yo gating, and zoomerating. Still got breath to save.
What did he say?
That's it. That's all I got. Any of you familiar with the Friday night TV host Gilardi now knows where he got the idea. No longer were they just disc jockeys. They were air personalities. In 1959, a young, enthusiastic disc jockey came to Cleveland from Detroit, heard Mad Daddy, and decided right then and then he had better have his own broadcasting style just as exciting. That man was Casey Kasem. And Clevelander Norman Knight was such a music buff, he began collecting interesting data about the recording artists and their songs, thus educating his radio audience about pop culture, and subsequently wrote several Rock On reference books. Thanks to these and other pioneering DJs, Clevelanders were right on top of the music and began making their own sounds, showing its diversity early on. Screamin' Jay Hawkins, Bobby Womack, Johnny Moore of the Drifters, and even girl groups. The first in Cleveland to have a hit record was the Ponytails. See if any of you recall this 1958 song.
Born to Lose.
Can I see hands? Okay, good. Yeah, they still play it on oldies radio. Keep in mind, these are all teenage girls. Beautiful harmony. And I may add that Susan Horning over here, who will be discussing recording in Cleveland in the next presentation, was a pioneer herself, having formed the first all-girl Cleveland rock band called the Poor Girls. By the mid-60s, there were a slew of area groups. Some made it no further than the outskirts of Ohio. Others hit big, like this band. Hands, familiar? I just heard it actually on the way up. That, of course, was a group called The Outsiders, and singer Sonny Geraci is still performing throughout the nation, and in fact will be at the annual Moondog Coronation Ball next Saturday at the CSU Convocation Center. Little plug there. The 70s is when rock really began splitting off into different genres and later subgenres. Pop rock, hard rock, psychedelic rock, blues rock, punk rock, bubblegum, and ah yes, disco. There's probably not a soul on earth that hasn't heard this tune by a Cleveland area band called Wild Cherry. This always gets people going. Who hasn't heard this song? Hands? See more heads bopping.
Yeah.
Okay, that was fun. This next 70s Cleveland band is now recognized as the first power pop band, the Raspberries. And of course, that group's lead singer, Eric Carmen, went on to a very successful solo career. We had great AM radio stations like WKYC, WHK, and no Cleveland baby boomer could forget Wixie 1260, who had the best jingle going. As a matter of fact, Amy Woolley was here, talked about advertising jingles yesterday, and no radio station did it like Wixie. Anyone remember how it goes? Thanks to this WVIZ videotape, we're able to reminisce a bit. Very good. Thank you.
Instead of saying it's 81 degrees outside, we'd say 81 degrees in the sunshine. Now, how bad is that? You know. Or, I'm going to serve up the cream of the top pop crop. Stupid as that. But it worked in those days, you know. I'm going to take you elbow deep in the ballot bowl. Here's a song to soothe the sad, suffering secretaries. Terrible. But everybody did it. You know, so it worked.
And this is Johnny Holiday reminding you to buy bond, save chicken fat, and join the wax.
But then the Kennedy assassination hits, and this malaise covers the world. But it's like Keith Richard of the Rolling Stones said, when the Beatles hit, February 64, the world was in color.
Who was at that concert? Anyone? 1964?
I had a younger sister, and she
my mother wouldn't let me
see the Beatles. I think I was the only male in the whole section, screaming girls, fainting all over the place.
They touched everyone's life, you know, no matter how old or how young, and they were coming to Cleveland. WHK is going to sponsor it.
Whenever you think WHK, you always think the Beatles. For some reason, they brought the Beatles here in 1964, and that had to be the most exciting year, you know, in all of rock and roll, in my opinion. You had Emperor Joe Mayer. You know, every time you saw a picture of the Beatles in Cleveland, there was Emperor Joe, you know, and he was right there. And whenever you heard him talk about the Beatles, it was as exciting as if you were in the room with the Beatles.
Emperor Joe and the WHK Good Guys must have made an impression on the Beatles. Take a close look. Yes, it says WHK Good Guys.
The WHK Good Guys, I think they were. Came out on stage, you know, and introduced themselves first, and we're the ones that brought the Beatles to Cleveland. Yeah, WHK! Cleveland history. Mayor Locher wouldn't let them come back in 65 because there was such pandemonium.
Loyalties changed quickly in top 40 rock radio. In 1966, a little 5,000-watt station, WDOK AM, changed its call letters and music and became the legendary
Wixie 1260 Super Radio.
Most people in a certain age group all listen to Wixie at one time or another. Pretty much, I would say, anyone from 40 to 60 years old that lives in Cleveland had the Wixie experience.
You must be in the ninth grade or older, so get with it. The village idiot, yo, lead the fastest tug in the Midwest here, Jackson Armstrong. And it's Kiss Your Sweetie time.
I like the variety of music. They play good music.
I think they were the greatest call letters. I mean, at the time, I remember, you know, Wixie 1260.
Here's a Wixie triple play.
three together, okay. Do I need to say more?
Here's the big C, triple play. Three together, okay.
And they were right on the dial between the stations. And so and it was not digital, so you dial down. The news comes on WHK at 55, and you start dialing down to KYC, and you hit Wixie in the meantime.
That's 136 at Wixie, and here's a song we have not heard in a long time.
It had one of the most limited signals in the marketplace. It was so on fire that even if you couldn't pick it up, you would say you listened to it. I grew up in Berea, and if within the household, somebody would turn on a TV set and a fluorescent light, between the whistle and the static, it would kill IXY at least at night.
Their transmitter may have been weak, but they could always rely on the great white-winged warrior.
Now, another exciting episode in the life of the
Who
most
remembers
fantastic
that?
Crime
Chicken
fighter
Man?
The world has ever known. Please take a note, Miss Helfinger, that Mr. Harbour will be available on weekends to fight crime as...
Yes?
Chicken Man.
Chicken Man?
Chicken Man. Be listening tomorrow for another exciting episode in the life of...
Great music, hot personalities, but something else also set Wixie apart. They were masters at the art of promotion. Not just on the air, but also on the streets. They made a point to be where you were, right in the middle of things.
By the way, now the outlook for the Wixie Bay Company Christmas Parade tomorrow morning, which starts at 9:30, will be partly cloudy.
Wixie boasted a constant schedule of events and contests. Remember Wixie Appreciation Days? Tens of thousands of fans thronged to this 1972 event at Edgewater.
We estimate maybe up to 50,000 people here, and everybody is, as you can see, having a great time.
My teenage daughter thinks that they invented flares and halter tops.
Satellite studio, which was truly a
showed her the video.
A converted ice cream truck. We thought it would be amusing to rock the truck while they were doing a live broadcast. The thing was to make the records jump around, and that's the end result when you start rocking the boat there. Much to the dismay truck. We thought it would be amusing to rock the truck while they were doing a live broadcast. The thing was to make the records jump around, and that's the end result when you start rocking the boat there. Much to the dismay of Johnny Walters at one point, I recall, and the Wild Child.
Well, high about 20 degrees, and honey, that is chilly. Wild Child, did
you imagine? Wixie certainly knew how to attract a crowd. One of their best remembered had a bigger is better theme.
We had a what we called the Francine contest. There was this woman who was well endowed who made the first pages of the papers because she walked from a subway station to her office in Wall Street every day. And we said, anything New York can do, we can do better. So we went to look for her in downtown Cleveland. We attracted something like 15,000 people on the corner of East 9th and Euclid at noontime.
Suzanne, have you always been like this?
Not always. I was little once.
How about you, Chief?
And I remember a big policeman on a big horse came up to me and said, "Hey, you guys got a license to do what you're doing?" And I said, "Officer, you don't get licenses to throw riots."
In 1966, Wixie was behind a riot of a different sort.
And of course, that goes on to the 1966 Beatles concert, which Wixie sponsored. By the mid-70s, AM radio popularity had waned in preference for FM, which had a looser format and free-spirited DJs who played whatever they wanted, including 22-minute long songs like Arlo Guthrie's Alice's Restaurant. And Clevelanders had the number one radio station in the country, WMMS, which, like AM's Wixie, were masters at promotion. Here's a fun story. Johan, who was the former Agora promotions manager, told me this story about MMS and its popularity. He says, "I'll never forget when I was in Lithuania in 1991, halfway around the world, into the Soviet Union in search of my father's farm. I'm smack in the middle of Countryville, and I drive up by this river and stop by the first farmhouse I see. I pull up to the driveway, and there's a car parked there, and it has a WMMS bumper sticker on it. This was in the middle of nowhere, in the fields of Lithuania, for heaven's sakes. I love that story, but that just goes to show you, it was everywhere. And there were clubs throughout the area that drew in young people every night of the week by offering a variety of live music, both local and beyond. The Agora Club was booking national and international acts with local bands opening for them, thus giving Cleveland bands great exposure. We also had the first Rock Reporter when the Plain Dealers' Jane Scott attended the first Beatles concert and became the most recognized face at concerts from that moment on. I need a bigger table. I want to read you this little quote from her, my book. Jane, you have to know her. She's just wonderful. She's in her 80s now, and you still see her at concerts everywhere. The Cleveland journalist is known nationally thanks to exposures from appearances on MTV, Good Morning America, Entertainment Tonight, and she's been profiled in Rolling Stone, People, and the Wall Street Journal. And that's not all, Jane notes. I was also in a pornographic magazine, she told a captive audience at the 1997 Rock Hall's An Evening with Jane Scott. I'll never forget the day someone came up to me and said, Jane, I saw you in Chick magazine. I didn't even know what that was, but I rushed to the store and purchased one. And sure enough, there I was. Apparently, the article in Rolling Stone was syndicated to other publications. But the most embarrassing part was that when I purchased the magazine, I ran into a member of my church. I felt I should explain myself, so I said, oh, I didn't buy this to read it. I'm in it. Well, that didn't help too much, she said. But it does expose her legendary sense of humor. And when you talk about rock and roll in Cleveland, you would be remiss in not mentioning our own version of Bruce Springsteen, Michael Stanley. Writers are right-brained, no left brain. Okay, the Michael Stanley Band was one of the earlier groups to have their music videos played on MTV.
In 1982, the Michael Stanley Band released the MSB album and headed back to Hollywood to film the video for the record's first single, Take the Time.
I remember them coming to us and being very, very shy about it, saying, you know, we want to do a video for this, but we want to do it as a Western. We filmed it at the Paramount Movie Ranch, which is where they captured Manson. So that's kind of special, isn't it?
The tour for the album once again kicked off at Blossom Music Center.
All right, Blossom!
MSB would play four nights in August, breaking the attendance record they set the year before.
Strike it up!
Strike Up the Band used to make us a little nuts. It was funny at the end part when Michael would come out and do the little rap and the spiel about strike it up, and all that stuff. We used to call that the fool.
Developed into this sort of, you know, shtick, and it was called, we ended up playing at the Fool part, because whoever did it, which was always me, you know, without there being a fool. And people would come off the stage and, you know, they wouldn't say anything like, oh, you sang good tonight, or, you know, it was a nice song, or this, they'd go like, hey, good fool tonight, you know.
Put your hands together now!
Another MSB concert staple, Women Rushing the Stage.
don't remember the first time it happened, but whenever the first time was, I remember being totally freaked out and scared by it. But you look at them and you're like, well, what are you, okay, you made it. Well, what are you going to do now, you know? Do you actually think like we're going to have sex right here in the middle of the stage, you know, like it's an opening act type of thing? I remember Mike Falcon talking to the guys and saying, to the security guys and saying, you know what? Like, let the first couple up. Let them admit, act like you're going to stop them, but let them off there, you know? This adds to the show.
Blossom used to have the, you know, the security up in front. He said, no, we don't want any security. We don't want any security. The guy's going to get killed. We don't want any security. The flowers, you know, during the shows were plentiful. We used to have a flower shop after the show. I made more money selling the flowers after the show than managing the band. Just kidding.
The MSB album failed to deliver a hit, so after the tour, work began on the next album, You Can't Fight Fashion.
MSB rocked the North Coast and beyond from 1974 to 1987. Throughout the history of rock and roll, Cleveland also gave the rock world the James Gang, the OJs, Chrissy Hynde, Joe Walsh, David Allen Coe, the Dead Boys, Devo, the Daz Band, Tracy Chapman, James Ingram, Bones Thugs and Harmony, Macy Gray, and even Marilyn Manson. Talk about musical diversity. There was also a blues band that played the club circuit for over three decades, particularly at the Euclid Tavern in University Circle, where the movie Light of Day with Michael J. Fox and Joan Jett was filmed. Nowadays, blues bands are plentiful. Back in the 60s, 70s, and every Saturday night during the 80s, at the Uke, there was only one, the Mr. Stress Blues Band. Yeah, I agree. The song you're about to hear, I Can't Quit You, Babe, was recorded live at the Euclid Tavern, and at the time, the Mr. Stress lineup included bass player Stutz Bearcat, now with the Armstrong Bearcat Band, and guitarist Alan Freed, who now fronts his own band and recently, as in a couple weeks ago, won the Freed Times Music Award for Best Guitarist in Northeast Ohio. There are so many creative musicians from the Cleveland, Akron, Canton, Kent, and Youngstown areas that I couldn't possibly include them all here tonight, though it does explain why my book weighs in at over 4 pounds or so. People have told me they use them to lift weights. And believe me, it could have been bigger. But I'd like to conclude with a song recorded in 1966. By a garage band consisting of 16-year-old Danny Klawan, who wrote the lyrics, and guitarist Wally Bryson, who later formed the Raspberries. The band was the choir, and the song, a typical Cleveland conversation piece. It's cold outside. Who remembers this song? Very good. All right. I'd like to finish with this little story that actually I ended the book with, because it really is a great example of how Clevelanders knew their music and lived for their music. Cameron Crowe, who was the writer-director for Almost Famous, he recalled reporter in the early 70s. And this is what he says about Cleveland. We were in the restaurant at Swingo's, and it was a booth, and for some reason it ended up all four members of Led Zeppelin in a row, and then there was Neil Preston and me. And this fan, like a true Cleveland rock fan, walked by. And he stopped, and he looked at the table, and he looked at all of them, and it's all Led Zeppelin sitting there, and us. And he goes, "Are you Neil Preston?" And the guys in Led Zeppelin were so disappointed. It was hilarious. But I never forgot that they were so rock knowledgeable in Cleveland that, okay, that's Led Zeppelin sitting there, but that's the famous rock photographer Neil Preston. And that was the way Cleveland always felt. Beyond the cliche of Cleveland Rocks and WMMS and all that stuff was the fact that all those bands couldn't wait to get there. So they would count down the days to Cleveland, seriously, even then. Any questions? Thank you. Child. Cleveland loved Wild Child. He was one of the most popular DJs of that station. Well, Clevelanders always liked the more unique personalities. Right, and that's actually what they like. Maybe because that's why Clevelanders gravitated to Mad Daddy so much, and then when Mad Daddy moved to New York, he bombed. I mean, they just didn't like him there, you know. So any other questions? Yes. Yes. Yes, it was. Right, yeah, and that's there's a gray area between the R&B and the rock, but of course, Alan Freed right away was calling it, by that time, rock and roll in a rock concert, so I think that's why they always say that was really considered the first, yeah. Right, you know. If it, yeah. Okay. Anybody else? Thank you so much. I really enjoyed it. I hope you did, too.